Welcome to our Berlin lunchtime meeting. My name is Heino von Meyer. I'm the head of the OECD Berlin Center here. The theme of our today's meeting is the Dragon's Dream. And this relates to the new slogan of the new Chinese leadership. And the title of the inauguration speech of the new Chinese presidents was the China Dream or the People's Dream. And let me just cite two sentences from Xi Jinping's inauguration speech. To attain the Chinese dream of the great renaissance of the Chinese nation is to achieve prosperity, revitalize the nation, and bringing about the happiness of the people. And he continues, to meet the people's desire for a better life is precisely our mission. This is interesting because I don't know if you have a logo here, the new OECD mission is also better policies for better lives. it's interesting, I mean, the dream as the slogan for such a big country. We are not here to dream, we are here now to look at facts, at performance and at perspectives of China. But clearly what's going on in China affects us in Germany. The German economy surely has survived the crisis better thanks to its strong relations to the Chinese economy. We have two eminent experts here to discuss these matters. Vincent Cohn from the OECD Economics Department and Professor Kepler from the President Emeritus of GIGA. And GIGA is the German Institute of Global and Area Studies. I hope that's right. Vincent will present the results of the new OECD Economic Survey, China. And I think this is remarkable also because China is not a member country of the OECD. But China accepted to be part of this peer review process, and we are quite keen to hear your conclusions. Vincent is, since 5 years, the head of the division in the OECD Economics Department, which deals not only with China, but also with India, with Japan, with Turkey, and Korea, and also with Northern European countries, so interesting mix of big and small countries. He joined the OECD in 95 and worked on various desks, starting with France, then Poland, UK, and Russia. He was from 2005 to 2008 economic counselor to the chief economist and the secretary general before he worked with the IMF and the Banque de France. So you see, he is French by origin. He studied at the Haute École, École des Hautes Études Commerciales, and got his PhD from the MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. After his presentation, Robert Kappel, who, as I said, was president of the GIGA and is still working as a senior expert for research fellow for GIGA. He was president for 8 years at GIGA, and before that he was professor in Leipzig at the Institute for African Studies. So he is not just focusing on Africa or China, but he really has a global approach. He studied in Freiburg economics, sociology, and political science, got his PhD, and did his habilitation at the University in Bremen. Long list of publications, which I will not go through, but just cite the latest title of one of his speeches, which he actually gave in March in Beijing, and where he talked about the economic power of regional powers and its impact on global institutions. So with these two experts on the panel, I think we'll have an interesting introduction to our lunchtime meeting, and then hopefully have enough time for discussion, followed by the lunch, because it's a lunchtime meeting. So Vincent, you have the floor.
I'm very happy to be here. I hope this works. Well, the button is red. Good morning to everybody, and thank you for coming to listen to this presentation of the China survey, which was released last month in Beijing by the Secretary General. I will go quickly through the slides, because there are many of them, but you will be able to look at them on the website of the OECD Berlin Center later on, if you so wish. And there's a summary of the report lying on the table, and copies, perhaps, of the report still available on the table for those who are interested. The focus of the report is on two hot topics, and they became hotter as we went along writing it: inclusive urbanization and greener growth. How hot they are, you can see from those quotes. The former Prime Minister Wen liked to underscore that the Chinese economy suffered from unsteadiness, unbalanced, uncoordinated, unsustainable growth. And his successor, Prime Minister Li Keqiang, is even more outspoken and more specific when he underlines, this is from a March speech, the fact that he wants to maintain growth, but he wants it to be sustainable. He wants to push through reforms and is not shy of referring to the vested interests, read state-owned enterprises, among others, who are standing in the way of reforms. He wants more inclusive growth, or opportunities for everyone. He wants urbanization, but smarter urbanization than what has happened thus far. And he wants a greener growth, so he wants more attention to the environment. The president this month also weighed in the same vein, underscoring that the days of frantic growth were over and that now one had to look at more reasonably paced growth. Perhaps 7 to 8% is the new normal, as opposed to 10% plus in the past. However, it's easy to spell out the problems and the reform areas. It's harder to actually implement them. And we were pleased to see that the China Daily, when they reported on our survey, underscored the implementation challenge that is associated with the reform proposals. Let's look at how China has performed in recent decades. You can see that even during the Great Recession, China continued to converge rapidly towards the more advanced economies. In fact, growth never fell below 9% in 2008, 2009, 2010, thanks to a massive and slightly unbalanced stimulus. So we have China zooming up on the right-hand side of this picture, even as the OECD was just crawling along. However, on the left-hand side, you can see that there is a change of regime, with growth coming down after the bump from double-digit rates to high single-digit rates. In the process, China has become the world's second largest economy. You can see this on the top left-hand panel, where you see China overtaking Japan a couple of years ago. This is at market exchange rates. You can also see at the bottom left-hand side that in PPP terms, China is on course to overtake the US by around 2016. However, it's important to keep in mind that China is, of course, much larger population-wise, and so if you think of living standards, that's the top right, bottom right panel, you see that living standards in PPP terms are only one-fifth or so of US living standards in China still. This is very difficult to read, but this is the table of projections that appeared in the survey, which I would like to highlight a few features of to illustrate how much rebalancing has occurred in the Chinese economy in recent years. I will not dwell on the growth numbers that are on the top right side. The 8.5% for this year are no longer feasible. Last week, on 15th of April, the National Bureau of Statistics released the Q1 numbers. 6.5% was the quarter-on-quarter annualized, the seasonally adjusted growth rate. That's way below what anyone expected. It was 7.7% year on year, also below expectations. So now reaching 8 seems like very difficult for this year. And 8 is no longer as sacred a number as it used to be in the past, when there was a slogan, Baobab, protect 8. Now 7.5 may be acceptable. What you can see, among other things, here in this table is that consumption has become, a couple of years ago, a more important contributor to growth than investment, which is a marked and important change, which we think will continue to be the case. You can also see that contribution of net foreign trade has shifted from a big positive number before the onset of the Great Recession to around zero. And this is notwithstanding the fact that in the first quarter of this year, this contribution was actually pretty big. The current account surplus was over 10% of GDP in 2007. These days, it's between 2 and 3% of GDP. So that has come down dramatically as well. A few dimensions of this rebalancing. Here you can see how the exchange rate of China vis-à-vis its main trading partners evolved over time. Both in nominal and even more so in real terms, you see steady appreciation over time, which has contributed to rebalancing and has, in fact, removed very much the China issue from the global imbalances conversation that was so intense a few years ago in the IMF circles. This is against the background of basically no longer an accumulation of the foreign exchange mountain until a couple of years ago. Foreign exchange reserves kept rising very fast. This stopped, although it has resumed in the first quarter of this year with, again, 130 billion accumulation in the first quarter, largely reflecting capital inflows. This is another dimension where you see that China, after WTO accession in 2001, was grabbing market shares very fast around the world, but that this process has slowed since that time. And this is a less well-known chart, which is, I think, very relevant. This is the rebalancing of public expenditures within China. You can see that social outlays over the past 5 years or so have increased dramatically in China, in particular for health, but also for pensions, also for social housing. Under the motto of harmonious society, which was the motto of the previous leadership, there were deliberate and resolute efforts to increase social outlays. And by this year, the level of total social spending in China is at the level of Korea, even a bit above. That said, of course, Korea itself is at the very low end of the OECD spectrum in terms of social spending, in part because their pension system is so recent, so I wouldn't make too much of this, but the change over time in recent years is very striking. And this explains why inequality seems to have declined in recent years in China. Of course, inequality is still very high. It has increased dramatically over the past three decades, but in recent years it seems to have leveled off. This is true for the Gini coefficient, if you look at the nation as a whole. It's true for the decile ratio. It's also true geographically, because there has been this rebalancing from the east coast towards the center and west of China. And it's also true if you look at the urban-rural divide, where inequalities have come down somewhat. Now, looking ahead at growth prospects and at the issue of the middle-income trap in which China may be stuck or not, one chart in the survey is very striking. It's China's trajectory in terms of growth compared to the countries like Korea, Japan, and others in East Asia that preceded it on the high-growth convergence path. And you can see that China, even if growth were to come down significantly over this decade, may well achieve the goal of the leadership, which is to double per capita income by the end by 2020. What will drive this continued convergence? Several forces. The first one is the fall in agricultural employment. This is the path of employment in the agricultural sector as a share of total employment, which currently is around one-third in China. And you can see Japan and Korea during their high growth years on the same chart. And you can also see, that's the solid line, the most advanced provinces of China. And if you assume that China as a whole will continue that's on a similar path, then you will see further increases in productivity as people shift from very low or zero productivity jobs in the agricultural sector to jobs in the urban areas where productivity is far higher. This will also be facilitated if indeed land reform advances in China and mechanization is facilitated in the countryside. One force that will work against this growth dynamics is demographics. Demographics has been one of the contributors to growth alongside investment and alongside productivity gains. A minor one, but a significant one in the past decades. It will become a drag going forward as the population ages. In fact, on the Chinese definition of the working age population, which is the group from 15 to 59 year olds, that group declined already in 2012. If we take our definition, it will decline a bit later, but the trend is clear. However, the quality of human capital is improving a lot. Here you can see what happened over the past 10 years to 2010 in China, a dramatic improvement, and it will continue to improve since compulsory education is now free and near universal in China, since it's pretty recent. So this will work its way through the cohorts and the quality of human capital will increase. Likewise, spending on research and development is also one of the drivers of growth and is increasing very fast. Here you can see how much progress China has made in recent years, and China wants to continue to push this up towards 2.5% of GDP for total R&D spending by 2020, which seems quite doable. However, the issue here is not so much quantity as quality, and there is a need to rebalance in the view of the survey spending towards fundamental research away from applied research. There's also a need to better protect intellectual property rights, both for domestic firms and for foreign firms, if that R&D is to actually spur growth as much as it can. One of the problems in China is the business environment, which remains very difficult. Foreign investors in particular, but also domestic ones, complain. This is just one example from the survey. It's not readable, but it's not meant to be read. This is all the things one has to do when one wants to engage in a construction project in China, all the different bureaucratic hoops. And most of them are redundant, but each of them allows some bureaucrat somewhere to pocket a bit of rent. Now, one of the driving forces of growth thus far and going forward is urbanization. Li Keqiang is very focused on that aspect. And one can see using the new data that have become available last year from the 2010 census, this is a very rich mine of data, which comes out only every 10 years and which is very interesting. You can see that population growth was concentrated in the largest 25 cities very much. In fact, at the right end, you can see that some cities saw their population decline as it migrated towards more dynamic places. However, China remains, in some sense, under-urbanized. The urbanization rate was 17% back in 1978 when China started to open up. It's now in 2012, 52.6%. But that's below the level that would be predicted by a simple linear regression between GDP per capita and urbanization rates. So there is scope, a lot of scope, for urbanization to continue in that sense. Another thing to underline is that living standards in China's richest cities are now pretty high. In fact, this is using the 2010 census data. You can see already then that in the 25 richest cities, living standards on average were comparable to Portugal's. Well, since 2010, Portugal's economy has shrunk and China's has increased by almost 20%. So by now, living standards in the 25 top cities in China are 25% higher or so than in Portugal. One factor that is important is that living space remains rather limited per person in China at around 22 meters on the Chinese definition, 22 square meters, so that's less in international terms. And so you can see that historically, over the past 12 years or so, there's a very strong relationship between the rise in income and the demand for living space. So that means not just construction of more units, but also bigger housing units. However, it is crucially important that urbanization be smarter, that we move towards compact cities, better public transportation, and so on. Otherwise, the population will just choke, as happened in Beijing in January this year. We have someone in the room, at least one person, who lives in Beijing and who may have suffered from this. This was the apocalypse, as it was called it by the people there. The meters just went wild with readings up to 40 times the WHO threshold. You can see the picture taken from the window of the US Embassy up there. You can also see a picture taken in Wuhan, which we visited back in June last year during the preparation of the survey, where there were also very noxious fumes coming out. Well, the origin was never really explained. We were told it was the farmers burning hay around the city, but that was not very credible as an explanation. And you can see, or you cannot see, there's a pie chart with the health cost associated with this air pollution. In the survey, there's a lot more data on that. One is satellite data that show that only in a few countries around the world is the situation worse than in China, and those countries are India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. And in China, the level of small particulates is almost three times the WHO threshold, which itself is a ceiling. Another way to cut through the data is to look at the distribution of this kind of pollution across cities, and you see that Chinese cities are way to the right of OECD cities or of other middle-income country cities. Turning to CO2 emissions, you can see that per unit of GDP, China is dirty, emitting a lot of CO2, but that per capita, it is much cleaner than the US, which is not saying much, but it does mean that China has a scope to move down in this chart, and they are trying to, despite the fact that things like increasing car ownership work against this trend, and well, Germany benefits from this, of course, but it is a problem, and the number of cities in China are restricting car ownership with the use of cars more and more drastically. This is a table that's also difficult to read, but it illustrates how seriously policymakers are taking the problems in China. In the 11th five-year plan, that was probably the first where environmental concerns featured quite prominently, and very strong efforts were made to meet some of the targets enshrined in this five-year plan, with actually strange effects towards the end of the plan period in terms of energy consumption. We had power cuts just to meet some energy intensity targets. And in the 12th five-year plan, the one we're in right now, running from 2011 to 2015, there are a lot of additional targets, and those targets are more binding than the notional targets that were in the previous plan. So they take it very seriously. And they are making progress on some fronts. This is one example, energy intensity, which I was referring to earlier. You can see that during the period of the 11th five-year plan, there was a drastic reduction in China, but coming from a very high level. How can further progress be made? Well, one way is to tax energy more. Energy prices are one of the few categories of prices that are still heavily regulated in China, and energy products are under-taxed. So we have a box in the survey with simulations, which were done using the model of the State Information Center, which has 137 sectors and uses the input-output table of 2007, which is very old by Chinese standards, but there was no more recent one. And that shows that if a small carbon tax were introduced, that could reduce emissions significantly. The number they look at is 10 RMB per ton, which is peanuts. It's 1/80th of the level in Sweden. And that would reduce emissions by 1%. But if you applied something a bit more substantial, like 100 RMB per ton, still very low, then you would cut emissions by perhaps 10% if you assume linearity in the model. But that's not insignificant. So we recommend to do that, and to do that rather than to go for ETS permits, because that's just too complicated. We visited several ETS exchanges that are being tried out in various provinces. And it just seems incredibly complicated to make that a success. In sum, is there a middle income trap in China? In our view, there's no statistical fatality. However, there is a policy trap. There is a risk that if a number of reforms are not implemented, then China might experience low growth going forward. And there are a number of risks, some of which I haven't even alluded to, like on the financial side, the risks associated with local public finance vehicles, the risks associated with wealth management products that are proliferating. There are the risks I discussed, like environment. There are a number of risks, and as Prime Minister Li has said himself at the symposium last week, the economy will have to climb hills and cross ridges. The policymakers are well aware that this is not going to be smooth. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. Quite a task to rush through an analysis of such a big country in 20 minutes. I think you've given us an excellent overview and very interesting insights into key aspects like urbanization or the challenges of environmental management and improving climate challenges, etc. Before moving into the discussions, we are keen to hear from Professor Kappel what his comments are, and maybe he wants to also add a few additional perspectives on the topic. Please.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everybody. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for a presentation with this huge, many, many data and this huge data set you presented here, which I think it was just a short version of the whole set of data. Okay, the report helps to better understand the huge economic, social, and political challenges of China, which is the country with the deepest and fastest economic transformation in the modern world. It developed from a closed society to a modern capitalist system and to an open trade regime. It is the second largest and fastest expanding economy. It is at the core of the G20. China is an increasingly significant global force moving forward with velocity. China catches up and converges and is a dominant economic power now. But it also faces massive problems which are tackled in the report. A very stimulating report, analytically strong, highly profound policy recommendations dealing especially with market reforms. You were not referring to this. I agree with much of the content of the report, which focuses on growth, urbanization, and environment. I will not summarize in 10 minutes the report, of course, the study, but focus my comments on six aspects. The report is describing growth imbalances, export sector development, but unfortunately the report does not differentiate that much. Where do imbalances stem from? Which export sectors grow? China's export structure has changed dramatically since the 1990s, and the share of high-tech sectors in China's export has increased from 7% in 1995 to about 35% in 2010. This indicates a significant technological and quality upgrading of Chinese export products. The explanation is that China's export quality technological upgrading is related to the high technology content of imported inputs and thus not so much embedded in the country's indigenous technological development until now. This may change, of course, in future time. I'll come to this later. The report deals indirectly with this upgrading process. The authors state that spending on R&D developed very fast and the education system is improving. The report says innovation capacity, I quote, is expanding strongly. Research and development is spending more than 2% of GDP. You quoted this also, so I stop here. I have doubts that this statement is taking into consideration that China's R&D expenditure and the R&D workforce is an adequate indicator for China's efforts, which are huge, and of course, and in some sectors, China's research activities are world-class. The data used do not tell us very much about the quality of research and development and of the education system. Just using quantitative data is not sufficient. For instance, average years of schooling is not an adequate measure. What is about the development of the national innovation system or even the regional innovation systems in China? Chinese colleagues told me that they are at the brink of such a process, and they complain about bureaucracy, the quality of Chinese research, and the average standards of school. So when the report said that strengthening innovation and competition is essential for sustaining growth, I agree totally, but we should realize that there are many obstacles inside the countries, the state-owned enterprises, schools and research institutions, and so on and so forth. Second, will rapid catch-up continue? If export growth is slowing down, as said in the paper, if wages are up and competition is on the rise, if the active working population is on the decline, and the decline of the population might be about 1 billion in 20-30 years, how can the PRC catch up? How is that possible? How can China continue growing at about 6-8%? The report says, with slowing productivity, I quote, an already high investment rate and aging society, continued rapid growth in manufacturing and service will require further transfer of labor from the agricultural sector to the urban centers. The question is China's future growth therefore depending mostly on rural-urban migration? Is rising urbanization a driver of income growth? The report says, yes, it is. Because of agglomeration economies, which allow larger cities to be more productive and so on and so forth. My question is, what will happen when migration stagnates? And this is not tackled in the report. Third, in my view, China's challenges are exacerbated by three specific problems that between them have the potential to stop growth or reduce growth, but that at the same time have become central in the nation's expansion. There is no doubt about the distorting effects of corruption in the economy as well on the morality and public life, as it results in misallocation of capital, shoddy work, and an absence of accountability, but it is integral to the way China operates. There is no questioning of the cost of ecological degradation. Pollution has been a direct product of the industrial advance of the last three decades. The report is showing how much China is affected by this degradation and the environmental problems, emission of greenhouse gases, energy-related carbon dioxide, air quality in the cities, and on and forth. I agree with the detailed recommendations. But the people grow increasingly angry about the buildup of pollution and health damage from factories. The environment has become a social and political issue and not simply a matter of trying to save China's ecology. Some observers believe that China will make significant progress as the central government encourages environmental protection and ecologically friendly growth. But the record to date has not been encouraging, as we have seen. Too many vested interests are at work in the opposite direction. Fourth, the demographic trap problem is tackled in the report, but not tackled clearly. You were saying it will become a drag. The combination of increased longevity with the falling birth rate means that the number of young people joining the labor market will shrink. There are millions of men who cannot marry because of the lack of young women and will not produce children. Plentiful young labor that has underpinned China's rise will be seriously affected by the PRC approaches. The lowest turning point at which the labor supply is no longer unlimited, while the number of old people at the same time who have been supported in a nation without adequate pension or welfare system rises. As you were stating, the social expenditure is rising very much. The number of workers aged between 20 and 29 is forecast to drop by a quarter between now and 2025, while the proportion of population aged over 60 grows from current 12 12.5% to about 20%, and then accelerates to 300 million by the year 2030. Okay, one third of the population, more or less. In 2011, Prime Minister Wen Jiabao has identified China as unbalanced. You also quoted this: unstable, uncoordinated, and unsustainable. The 12-year plan aims to rebalance the economy by boosting consumption. The same was said by Prime Minister Li, maintaining growth. Central and Western China were to be developed to catch up with the coastal regions. Urbanization was to be pursued. China was to move up the technological chain by producing own cars, own airplanes, machinery, nuclear industry, and environmentally friendly energy-saving equipment, becoming a leader in biotechnology, next-generation information technology, new materials, and new power generation, and so on and so forth. This sounds very ambitious, very good, but who will organize the next step to such a scumpitarian regional or national innovation system? Who are the actors? The central government with its 1 million civil servants, or the provinces and the townships and villages with 45 to 50 million civil servants, many of whom are more interested in pursuing local interest than implement the central strategy? So that is might be something like a contradiction or a fight, even a fight inside the party and the elite in China. Six, report leaves out the question, who are the agents of change in China and the veto powers? What is about more local participation? Huge debates going on in China on these aspects. Everybody is involved in debates on this and that. Food security, food safety, labor conditions in agriculture and industry, land reform, migration, training, and the whole transformation process. A huge debate is going on. And what we should, what perhaps everybody knows here in this room, is that Chinese people are very pragmatic, so they will solve the problems. I'm very optimistic about this. But so far the question remains, which way China, when you focus on environment and degradation, combined with growth and the aging population, which causes a lot of social problems, and the state has to find solutions for the social security of the people. So there is a long way to better life, and I try to avoid the word happiness, because the countries which have found out that they are happy are mostly poor countries. Bhutan, for instance, and Denmark, that's an outlier. Sorry. Thank you so much for your presentation and the report. I learned a lot.